Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's program, National Immigration Forum Call on Refugee Admissions. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note this call may be recorded. I'll be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Kathleen Farrell. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, operator. Good morning and welcome to the National Immigration Forum press call. According to reports, the President is meeting with high-level advisors at the White House today to discuss the refugee ceiling for the coming year. Recent reports suggest that the President may reduce the ceiling from this year's historically low number of 30,000 and possibly set a cap at or near zero. I'm pleased today to welcome four speakers who will address the problems inherent in the United States' potential abandonment of its status as a beacon of hope to the world's refugees. With us on the call are Leif Anderson, President of the National Association of Evangelicals, Gideon Maltz, Executive Director of the Tent Partnership for Refugees, Ambassador Ryan Crocker, diplomat in residence at Princeton University and former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon, and Aruj Nirmal, a former refugee who lives in Spokane, Washington, and is waiting to reunite with her husband. With that, I'll turn it over to our first speaker. Leif, please go ahead.
On the 23rd of July, a letter was sent to President Trump from evangelical leaders. I signed the letter, the president of the Assemblies of God, college presidents, Russell Moore from the Southern Baptist, asking that we return to a normal standard of 95,000 per year and not the cut to 30,000 or less than that. And there are a couple of reasons for doing that. My reasons are, as an American, as an evangelical, I recognize that there are more refugees than at any time since World War II, that there are millions of displaced, desperate, and needy people, that we can't help them all, and that other nations are doing their share, some more than their share. So the world looks to the United States as a leader and an example. If we are generous, other countries will be generous. If we are not, they won't be. So America should lead the world and not leave the world of refugees. So let's be generous and compassionate and welcome those and do our share, just our share, of welcoming refugees. But also as an evangelical Christian, I take the Bible seriously. And the Bible is a book of refugees, from the nation of Israel to the baby Jesus and his parents taking refuge in Egypt. The Bible is a book of compassion toward others in need, of the golden rule that we need to think what we would want done for us if we were in their circumstance. And so to sum it up, my Christian faith is what calls me to bless and help refugees. And so I call on our government to bless and help refugees. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Leif. Our next speaker is Gideon Maltz, Executive Director of the Tent Partnership for Refugees. Please go ahead, Gideon.
Hi, I'm the Executive Director of the Tent Partnership for Refugees. We're a network of more than 100 major businesses that are committed to supporting refugees around the world. I want to be clear up front that the principal reasons for U.S. resettlement of refugees are humanitarian, as you heard, and strategic, as you'll hear in a moment. But I also want to say that we also know that once in the United States, refugees flourish and make a valuable contribution to the business sector and to the economy. Far from being a cost, as they're sometimes portrayed, refugees make America more prosperous. First, many businesses see refugees as valuable members of their workforce. In fact, they often find that refugees are some of the most dedicated, loyal, and productive workers. We commissioned a report that found that refugees stay in their jobs three times longer than other workers. Especially now, with an extremely tight labor market, businesses are looking to refugees to fill key labor gaps. Second, refugees have higher rates of entrepreneurship than U.S.-born residents or even than other immigrants. Third, when given the opportunity, refugees have made contributions to the U.S. economy at the highest levels. Google, WhatsApp, and PayPal were all founded by refugees. And companies like Uber and TD Bank today have refugees as their CEOs. Fourth, every major economic study has found that refugees on net make a positive contribution to the economy. For example, economists at Notre Dame found that 20 years after arrival, refugees have contributed $20,000 more in taxes than the government has actually spent on them. So overall, refugees are making America more prosperous and better off. And the final point I just want to leave you with is that the infrastructure that the United States has for refugee resettlement is the envy of the world. Nobody does a better job of resettling refugees. We have a network of resettlement agencies that are absolutely critical to integrating refugees into the labor market, and businesses rely on these organizations to provide a pipeline of refugee workers. These organizations are already under acute stress, and a further reduction or elimination of the refugee program could force many to shut down with long-term consequences, because this is an infrastructure that won't easily be restored. So it's not just an immediate challenge, but it potentially creates severe implications for the long-term too. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gideon. Our next speaker is Ambassador Ryan Crocker, diplomat in residence at Princeton University and former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. Please go ahead, Ambassador Crocker.
Thank you. Those six countries to which I was the American ambassador, every one of those six has either received refugees, have sent refugees out of their country, or done both at different times. How we lead, the example we set, is extremely important globally. If we are seen as stepping up to the challenge of welcoming refugees, others are much more likely to do the same. If we don't, the reverse is also true. Others will not step forward, and an already desperate humanitarian crisis gets that much worse. Stepping forward for America, it does not mean taking a million refugees or anything like it. As Lee said earlier, we are really pushing here for a return to normal, which is about 95,000 refugees a year. That is a drop in the ocean compared to the overall number. It's symbolic. Symbols count in the international world that I've spent so much of my life in. So by showing a welcome, we cause others to do the same. If we pull that mat up, so will others. And again, a bad situation becomes worse. Two other quick points on security. Everyone is concerned about that in this country. They should be after 9/11. There is no class of applicants to visit the United States that is more thoroughly screened than refugees are. I mean, none. Students, tourists, whatever, are all screened, certainly, but no one gets the intense treatment than refugees do. The second point I'd make is that by taking steps that could lead to really the deconstruction of the entire resettlement effort in this country, as Gideon pointed out, that is not going to make us any safer. The contrary will be true. If we don't lead in this area, no one else will either. And really, the international community then becomes a much less safe place. So whether we're talking about our values, or our security interests, to do the right thing by allowing, again, a small number, relatively speaking, of refugees into this country is important to both.
Thank you, Ambassador Crocker. And our final speaker this morning is Arush Nirmal of Spokane, Washington, herself a former refugee. Please go ahead, Arush.
Hi, this is Arush Nirmal Sahoon, and I'm sorry, guys, I'm not as good as you are, and if I say something inappropriate or not proper, please excuse me for that. I just wanted to say that first before I started. So, I am I'm a refugee, and I flee my country back in 2013 because I was been persecuted as a Christian persecution. So I was in Sri Lanka for quite a really long time. Then I left my country and been there as a refugee. So the moment I stepped into Spokane, a World Relief are people who help me and they host me, and I've been really generous. I'm very grateful to all of you people who has been helped me to settle down. And throughout every process I have to go through being in here. And for now, me and my husband has been separated for a really long time. It's been a really long time that I am looking forward to see him in here, but he's still in the process, and you're working on it, and everything is going according to the process. But ever since I get to know about this, these law and orders has been approved, or I hear about that this is what going on through Director of World Relief, Mark Finney. He told me that this is a new order that is just going through the process and stuff. That makes me feel really scared and nervous about it. I don't know what's going on. Is that all government officials and higher authorities are definitely doing a great job. I have nothing to say or do about it. And with all due respect, our president of America has the decision, which me and my husband genuinely believe that he absolutely right. There's nothing wrong about it, because if the house is on fire, that's what parents do. They would definitely take care of their kids first before their neighbors. And this is something totally understandable. There is no question mark about it, and we do respect that. But still, in that situation, for refugees like us, or who are being separated by their loved ones, and the families who have been devastated for a really long time are not in the safe position, assuming that if they will never get to see their family back again or their loved ones, what is going to happen? It's just so painful and heartbreaking for the people like us. And what I can say is that that's my very humble High Commission and all these government officials to please finally take a generous look to all these cases who have been separated and devastated for a really long time and waiting for their loved ones. If they are clean and there is nothing, they are happy to serve this beautiful and wonderful nation. Do something about it if you can help us to do that. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Arush, for sharing your story. Operator, could you please explain to media on the line how to queue for questions?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, press star 1 on your touchtone phone. One moment while we queue. Now we'll take our first question from Harvest Prude from World Magazine. Your line is open.
Hi, yes, this is Harvest. Thank you so much for doing this. I have a question for Arush, if she's okay with sharing. I was wondering if you could share a little bit more specifically about what kind of persecution you were fleeing. And I was wondering if your husband is also in a dangerous position right now, or kind of what his situation is.
Okay. So the persecution was about sharing the Pakistani persecution with the other people all over the country. They are not in the safe position where we are living in right now. And that was the reason why we were in a mess, I would say, or in trouble. And my husband is still in Sri Lanka, and like you people already, you guys already probably know about it, that in this year, April 2019, there was a bomb blast by Sri Lanka, exact the same day of the Easter day that has held over there. And he was in really bad shape or really bad situation, because if that incident, when that happened, when that bomb blast happened, well, not just him, there were people like Pakistani Christians were in that kind of a situation. They were just running around and finding a safe place for what exactly happened to him. I can share that with you because this is what I know. I don't know about other people, how did they find out to find a safe place or something. So according to him, what he told me is that where they were living, and the owner of that house, they were living with, okay, he were living with the other bunch of guys living together at the one place, like to survive and to stay there. I don't know. Yeah. So they just told them to leave that place within 30 minutes. Otherwise, the cops are coming after them and they are gonna kill them, or there are other Sri Lankan people who are really mad at this time because they lost their families in that bomb blast, and we cannot take your responsibility. So you have to leave this place within 30 minutes. We don't care where you can go or how you can save your life, but just kind of, they just take them out of their house within 30 minutes without any notice, right after that bomb blast. So when they have been to, there were no other place for them to go to because they were completely banged. People were after them for killing them because they were definitely mad and upset because they lost their families, which is totally understandable. We do understand that. We really feel bad for all those innocent people who lost their families, but still being Pakistani Christians, they don't care. I mean, no matter whether they are Muslim or Christian or whoever they are, for at the same mean time, they were just after Pakistani Christians or Pakistani people. So he was one of them who was struggling with survival or having a safe place or something. So all of the guys, and he himself went to the police station asking them for help, and they totally refused to help them first. And then they were dragging them over different police stations saying that you're not our responsibility. You're from this domain and we don't care about this domain. We don't care about you people. You just go to somewhere else and talk to them. If you will be in here, you will be in trouble. Sri Lankan people are going to be mad at us for having you here. So I hope you understand what I'm trying to say, is that they were in really bad shape and been dragged over and over again all over different places for having a safe place, but everybody else like them were in really, really crucial situation for quite a couple of months. And then by now they are all in refugee camp, a kind of a refugee place, I would say, where other refugees are living as well, but being very honest, I would say that not as bad as they were. But of course, being Pakistani, I don't think that is any more safe place for our Christian refugees or people who are living over there, because they have already been through this situation where they were in trouble, and we cannot trust those people who lost their families. Definitely they're in pain, and they, for revenge, they can do anything or anytime they want. And this is kind of really confusing situation to say. I don't know how to explain this feeling, but I'm kind of nervous for my husband. Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah. You're welcome.
We'll take our next question from Irene Nguye of the Scripps Washington Bureau.
Thank you so much again for organizing this press call and for sharing your story, Arooj. My first question is for Ryan. We want to know what measures can be taken to cause the administration to raise the cap, and who can take these steps, like civil society groups, lawmakers, who can cause the president to raise the cap?
I'm sorry, ma'am. I didn't hear your question really clearly. Can you repeat it for me?
Hello?
Sorry, the question's for Ambassador Crocker.
Yes, it's for Crocker, and our question is, what measures can be taken to cause or compel the administration to raise the cap, and who can take these steps, like civil society groups or lawmakers, or both?
It's a great question, and the answer, I think, is all of the above. I mean, it's one of the reasons we're doing this event, that we are all on this call to flag that, to severely cut the number of refugees we take or go to zero, is not the right way to go for the United States. And again, it's a question of our values of who we are. Except for Native Americans, all of us came here from somewhere else. Some as refugees, some as immigrants, some were forced here in chains from Africa, but we all came from somewhere else. That's fundamental to our national identity. To close down refugee admissions is, frankly, would be a repudiation of what America has always been about. So it's delivering that message in Congress, through the media, through other interactions, through meetings, to send the word out that refugees are us. They always have been in this country. So I would just urge you and anyone else who's interested in this issue, and I hope everyone is, to spread that word that this is about American values and it's about American security. If we don't lead on this issue, no one else will. And the worst refugee crisis since World War II, a time when we did lead on refugees as well as everything else, is going to get a whole lot worse.
Yes. Thank you so much for sharing that, Ambassador. And my second question is for Mr. Anderson regarding white evangelicals. There's a 2018 Pew Research survey that found that white evangelicals are least likely to say the U.S. should accept refugees. So we're just curious about that contradiction, especially in light of leaders such as yourself who are vocal advocates of the refugee resettlement program. How do you explain this contradiction, and why does it even exist?
Yeah, thank you for the question. There are lots of different evangelicals, and it's a movement that has segments within it. So I'm sure there are segments who do not want refugees or other immigrants to come to the country. I would contend that those who are evangelicals who are driven by the values and the teachings of the Bible about refugees and immigrants are those that are most favorable to refugees coming, recognizing that there are limits to it, but concerned that there are Christians who are being persecuted along with other religious people around the world, and they have a compassion for them and think the United States should step up and do it. And yeah, I guess I would prefer when we have conversations among evangelicals that they always start with the Bible rather than cable news.
Yes, thank you so much. And my last question is for Mr. Mo, Peter Mo. I was wondering if you have any data on the economic contributions of refugees to the U.S. economy. You mentioned refugees who are leaders of industry, and I was just wondering if your organization tracks their economic contributions to the economy.
We, as an organization, we don't track that. There are several terrific economic studies that have come out in the last year that do summarize the overall economic contribution. I referenced one, which is a study by economists at the University of Notre Dame, which found that on average, an adult refugee contributes $20,000 more in taxes than they receive from the government. That's measuring one aspect. There's a couple of other studies that I'd be happy to share with you offline. I don't have them at the at my fingertips, but there is a pretty robust set of economic evidence.
Thank you so much. I'll follow up with you offline.
We'll take our next question from Connor Finnegan of ABC News. Your line is open.
Hey, thank you for holding the call. I wanted to put two things that the administration often counters with to whoever would like to respond, really. First, they say that they have to admit and process fewer refugees because they need to provide more resources to handle the backlog of asylum adjudications. What would you say to that argument? And then second, even when they've announced the cap the last 2 years, including the lowest in the program's history, Secretary Pompeo said that the U.S. still remains the most generous nation in the world. What would you say to that as well? Thank you.
Ambassador, would you like to take this one? Sorry, I think the ambassador had to ring off. Leith, could you take this?
Yeah, there are a couple of questions there. Leith Anderson, National Association of Evangelicals. On the question of asylum seekers, that is one part of the government and one part of the process. However, refugees are handled by nine what are called VOLAGs, which are volunteer agencies. They're all approved agencies of the federal government, and they are the ones that handle the refugees when they come into the United States under government authorization. So the government is more than able to be able to do both, since there are different groups of people that are handling it. As to the United States being the most generous nation in the world, that is a title I would love for us to keep, and this is an opportunity to demonstrate that generosity. If we maintain the current levels of refugees, that is minimally generous. If we increase it, it is an example to the world. If we decrease it, we will no longer be the most generous nation in the world.
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. We'll take our next question from Diane Solis of Dallas Morning News. Your line is open.
Hello, everyone. Thanks again for the call. Has litigation ever been filed to challenge the increasing restrictions of the Trump presidential cap, or is that even a legal option?
Lise, could you take that one?
Yeah, I'm not technically sure on this, but my understanding is that it is what is called a presidential determination. So I think it is within the purview of the President of the United States to set that number, but you really need to talk to a lawyer.
Okay. So you're left with the power of persuasive argument and leveraging stories of successful refugees?
Well, it's a combination of things. It is certainly the stories of refugees. It is also the value system of the United States and how we live that out both within our country and how, you know, both Ambassador Crocker and I have repeatedly said it is the example that the United States sets. I guess I would like the administration to think in terms of the leadership that we give to the world, because if other countries follow our example and the number is reduced, that has further cataclysmic consequences. Also, this administration has talked a great deal about the importance of religious liberty and valuing people who are persecuted, and this is an opportunity to live that out. So I think that argument needs to be forcefully made, that there are people who are suffering particularly for religious persecution. Many of them are Christians, but they are Muslims and Hindus and others, and that we need to do our part, not everything, but do our part. And I think those are powerful and persuasive arguments.
Thank you, Leith. And operator, we'll take our final question, please.
I'll take our next question from Tovin Lopen of Fortune. Your line is open.
Yeah, thanks for doing the call. Actually, it's sort of two questions, if that's all right. One was I wanted to ask if you're seeing this already with the drop from 95,000 to 30,000, if you're already seeing this affect refugee resettlement resources in American communities, and if there's any particular stories you've heard of maybe particular areas where they can't get the workers they find, or they're not able to resettle the same number of refugees that they previously did. And my last question was just if you've seen other countries internationally follow this U.S. lead to reduce the number of refugees and are maybe not being as welcoming because the U.S. is not taking this leadership role.
Yeah, I'm happy to answer. I'm certainly the first, and I can take a stab at the second as well.
Go ahead, Gideon.
So in terms of the first question, absolutely, we've already seen a huge impact from the reduction from historical levels in previous administrations. And we've heard this from two sources. I mean, one, we've heard this from the resettlement agencies that their budget is provided by the U.S. government consistent with the number of refugees being resettled, and there's already been very significant effects on these resettlement agencies across the country, with a number having to close local offices. So these resettlement agencies are already under severe stress, and already the infrastructure is being badly damaged. We've also heard it very loudly from companies we work with. We work with a number of companies that very interested in hiring refugees, see the potential for refugees in their workforce, and simply aren't able to find enough in the communities where they operate because of the significant reductions in refugee admissions the last couple of years. On the second question, I think what we've seen in the last couple of years is several countries, including Lebanon and recently Turkey, really sort of reversing previous policies of being more accommodating and welcoming to refugees. Obviously, there's complicated internal dynamics that's partly explaining it, but it certainly matters that the U.S. government, which you know has important relationships with all these countries, isn't in a position to sort of set a symbolic and moral example through its own actions to engage these governments and urge them to do the right thing themselves. So I think we are already beginning to see some consequences with how other governments are acting.
So that concludes our call today. I'd like to thank our speakers, Leif Anderson of the National Association of Evangelicals, Gideon Maltz of the Tent Partnership for Refugees, Ambassador Ryan Crocker, diplomat in residence at Princeton University, and Arush Nirmal, former refugee now living in Spokane, Washington, and awaiting reunification with her husband. Thank you all very much for your time. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You're welcome. Yeah, wonderful day. God bless you.